If you're caring for aging parents, you need Parent Projects Connect. Here's why. First, you get access to a verified business network, so you're only working with the most trustworthy vendors who won't take advantage of your situation. Second, Parent Projects guides you through modules and tasks on health, financial, real estate, and medical decisions, so you're always prepared for what's next. Third, you can invite family members into your project so your family is in the know and working together. Get started with a free 30-day trial today at parentprojects.com.
I'm going to die someday. And you know what? You are too. And that is partly something that we get to share in this human experience between all of us. Michael Conley today is going to join us with his book, Journey's End. And I got to tell you, in a quick read, just great bits of nuggets. The psychology and well-being depends on our belief that we are valuable contributors to a meaningful world. Some of this stuff and how we look at death is amazing for us, but in sometimes it becomes something that blocks us from being able to advocate best for those that we love. Stay tuned today as we talk about the journey's end with Michael Conley on the Parent Projects podcast.
Listening to Parent Projects, a family media and technology group production. Now here's your host, Tony Siebers.
Hey, today we're going to be chatting with author of the medical industry, he's an insider, Michael Conley, about how we approach end-of-life care in America. We're going to talk about some of the practical benefits that are we can have when we face death a little bit differently, when we look at it as a reality other than just something that we try to medicalize. Michael's book, The Journey's End, it's an investigation into death and dying in modern America. And this is going to highlight some of the areas that we discussed today. I want to welcome you, Michael. Welcome to the Parent Projects podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hey, so this is, we share a lot of things in our background, faith and in our outlook and stuff like that is one big one, which helps us, I think, probably be able to approach the experience and the conversation of death relatively openly, pretty openly here. But there are going to be those of you that are joining us online that this is going to be a really difficult subject. So if, you know, you get into this, I'll put up front that caveat up in the front. It's a good time to sit and reflect on. Use experienced people to help you process death. If it's a difficult thing for you, look for psychologists and psychiatrists and other folks that can help you deal with those challenges there and unpack some of that emotional baggage. But today, we're gonna really tackle some of that. And this is that warning and that caveat up front. We're going to talk about some of those key dynamics that make this so stinking difficult at end of life. And we're going to give some real tips and tools for how you can overcome that and be the best advocate you can possibly be, moving yourself from guilt and fear and leaving yourself open to find, man, just a little bit of love and laughter in those end of days as you advocate for your loved one. So, Michael, it's a big lift that we got today. Thanks for joining me to do it, man. Are you ready to dive in?
I'm ready.
Okay. Oh, we've got those of you, by the way, that are following us. You can grab us at parentprojects.com if you're coming in from one of the social media feeds. And up there, upper right-hand corner, you hit that podcast and you can join us. If you've got questions you want to put up, there's an open chat up there. Feel free to throw those questions in there and we will take them into the show as we kind of make our way through it. So, look, Michael, give us a little bit of your background, will you? And how it is that you came to spend so much time and attention and care so much about the end of life and what this journey brings for us?
So I started in healthcare when I was 16. And my first jobs were an orderly, a security guard, and a landscaper. And I fell in love with healthcare. And I thought that working in a hospital was like a microcosm of society. You had every level of society, from the most sophisticated and affluent to the, you know, indigent to, you know, the housekeeping staff, maintenance staff. And we all lived together all day long. And it was just a wonderful experience. So I've spent my life in healthcare, that from the day I fell in love with the day I started those jobs. And I've become progressively frustrated over the lack of healthcare's ability to make change and adjust. And it's become so bureaucratic. And one of the worst areas, in my opinion, in healthcare is how we take care of the elderly.
Yeah. Well, and end of life issues have a lot of dynamics when you're I think we'll talk through some of those advocate, you know, when you're advocating from someplace else. But it seems like it really kind of starts in our own view of death. What are, you seem to have a grasp against that. What helps inform how you look at death? What are those markers, or how is it that you look at death? If someone were to kind of listen to what we're talking about today to see where you're coming from.
So ironically, it's asking yourself what it means to be alive. So, you know, it is, you know, is helping others an important part of your life? Is being aware of the people you're around an important part of your life? And then think about, if you lose those things, you know, I mean, the most common issue today is getting Alzheimer's. And so do you still want to get all the health system has to offer if you have Alzheimer's? And it's likely that you will. So, you know, a common example is you get an infection. Well, in the old days, that was just a gift. And now you'll get an antibiotic. And, you know, you'll continue not knowing anybody for another 5 years.
Yeah.
And so really thinking through, and then what'll happen is you'll have care choices at the end of life, and very specific ones, whether it's ventilators or whether it's going to the hospital or whether it's a feeding tube, and really understanding what those things are and whether you really want them and under what conditions do you really want them.
Yeah, having, being informed about what life means for you and your place against that seems like it really is it's one of the biggest filters against your ability to understand how it should come to an end, or when your mission's complete, or when your work may be done at some level. And when we as fast as these things start to fly, we're gonna take a knee here for a second for our sponsor. But when we jump back into this, there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of dynamics of where individual people that are all on their own individual journeys, or they've got other influences professionally or personally that are influencing where they come to the table. I'd like to sit down, and when we come back, let's break down some of those dynamics that are at play while we're trying to figure ourselves out at the end of life here this week, as we're talking about A Journey's End with Michael Connelly, author of the book.
Sometimes I'd like to smack old age right in the kisser. Ow!
I always get the best parking spot.
I think she needs a little more help.
Monday?
What I really need is a boyfriend that can drive at night.
I can make a fashion statement out of anything.
I will be fabulous.
I have a little crush on my pharmacist.
With Comfort Care at your side, you can live your best life possible. We know families can't be there 24/7, which is why we can help with as much or as little home care as you need. From medication reminders and meal prep to everyday chores and errands, so you can live in your own home on your terms.
I wouldn't let aging stop me from being me.
Call Comfort Care now and let us create your personalized care plan and find the perfect caregiver match.
Can you show that number again?
She was texting.
Together with Comfort Care, you can both live your best life possible.
Hey, and welcome back. This week we're with Michael Connolly of The Journey's End. Healthcare insider. He's someone who's had a great perspective to understand that machine of healthcare that sits around us that eventually tends to play a role in most of our lives, unless and honestly, it's one that will take off on its own unless we've got some specific ways that we want to approach it and have made ourselves heard about that. So, Michael, thanks for joining us. We're going to dig into some of this other stuff real quick. If you do follow this and you're listening to the program, if you like how we're challenging stuff and we're bringing out some useful information, I just help us spread this mission and help us spread the word by liking, subscribing down below, sharing our podcast out with others that could make use of that, and provide some feedback. You can catch us at parentprojects.com up off the podcast page and give the feedback. Let us know what you're looking for, and we are happy to run out and go get that information and bring those tips to the table. So, Michael, dynamics. Man, I have a list like this long from our previous conversations that we've had up here. So we've got doctors, we've got third parties, we've got our own issues, we've got other family members, we've got treatment and how testing gets done about stuff. We've got general looks on medicine. Let's dive in against this. Talk to us about the healthcare industry in general without pointing a finger or plugging at it. What are these dynamics that doctors have weighing on them? This most informed, educated person typically that we turn to in times of trouble or medical duress or something that might be a natural part of death, because that involves that. What in your experiences, what's going on with them?
So, I mean, they spent decades learning how to cure you.
Yeah.
They were taught in that process that you dying is failure. Mm. And the dilemma is that, you know, if you're 30 or 40 years old, that's, you know, purely you want to be saved. But yeah. If you're 80, maybe you don't want to be saved. But their thought process is they don't distinguish that you're 40 or 80. They're just going to try to save you. And so furthermore, then they'll be sued if they don't do everything for you.
Yeah.
Every doctor is always afraid of being sued. So that's another dynamic. A third dynamic is that the safest place when you're older is at home. And if you want to stay there, you're going to panic when something goes wrong. Somebody falls, and then you're going to call 911, and then you're going to go to the hospital and you're going to end up in ICU. That's not a good thing. But unless you've thought about this stuff, and unless you're comfortable and you have some place to reach out to sort of walk you through, no, you don't need to go to the emergency room, then things can change. But once you get in that hospital, the machine begins and yeah. They're going to start diagnosing and everything else.
Now, one thing that was that you brought up earlier in one of our conversations is that a lot of the medical procedures that we use, life-saving medical procedures, a lot of the stuff in general, it was likely not tested on older people or people of older age. So our understanding maybe of side effects or what impacts it might have on other, we hear that cause and effect, right? One thing, and I think we all just know it, right? We've done something, we've taken something, dealt with this, but then I got this to deal with. Or we went in and we got this worked on and I ended up with this thing over here. There's a dynamic as well of that in medicine. True?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact is that they test up on young people. They don't test it on old people. Yeah. And one of the interesting statistics is how many people die shortly after they go to the emergency room. In old age, because it's so disorienting. I mean, they're fragile with all kinds of problems. And once they get in there and they lose all that, there is like 90, there's a high death rate for people 90 days after an ER visit when they're very old.
Yeah.
So it's really understanding what works and what doesn't work as you age.
Well, and there is, I mean, we see it also specifically in Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, right? Where that slope, as soon as you remove them from the home, the familiarity of those things, that it undoes them. And sometimes that recovery never comes all the way back from that. When they right. when they come back, even when they settle back at the house, I don't know if trauma is the right word to use there, but there's some level of definite shock to the system, and perhaps even some level of trauma to that you're dealing with. Instead of just dealing with life, you're now dealing with what you witnessed or went through while going through life.
Well, I'll give you a quick little story about my sister. My sister died of COPD, which, you know, she can't breathe. She was a heavy smoker. And I would say about 18 months, short of dying. So she was well advanced with COPD. She wasn't able to get her steroid prescription refilled. That's another story. And she couldn't breathe, so she goes to the emergency room. She ends up being hospitalized for 2.5 days, and they were diagnosing her as having heart failure, which was not all she needed was steroids. And when she got out of the hospital, she turned to me and said, "We don't need capital punishment in Wisconsin. We just need to stay in the hospital." And after that, we put her into hospice, and she was never happy.
Yeah.
But she never went back to that hospital. She never went to any hospital. It's a great hospital. I mean, that's where I started working. But it's just the way the system works.
You know, in that system, you know, some other things that work against us in the medical system in general, palliative care or caring for those, just kind of working through those. That's really not a thing of that medical system. Is that right? That's not something that's generally a part of that yet, in full force across the country.
Yes. So the specialty of palliative care was created in 2006. And it was in response to the fact that our end of life care is so poorly done. And so it recognized that we needed to change this. But then the payment system doesn't really reimbursed for palliative care.
Yeah.
And so where it would be very valuable would be in an outpatient setting. So, you know, going to a palliative care doctor or a palliative care nurse to complete your advanced directives and discussing them, you know, annually thereafter would be wonderfully beneficial. But those doctors don't exist and you can't get access to that. The only way they use it in the health system is there are palliative care teams that are called into ICU when people don't, you know, they don't know how to turn anything off and they need somebody to talk to them about it. And that's how they end up being used. And there are some economics as to why that pays for itself. But the point is that that's way too late.
Well, and there is that takeaway against that is the economics. And by now, many people are probably understanding in their parent project that they're along in it more than a couple of months. Economics plays a role in this. Funds fuel mission. There's whether it's the economics of what your parents can afford or what the family can afford to chip in, or if you get into a entitlement system, a Medicaid, a Medicare, any of these types, even if you're working off a long-term care insurance policy, right? They're still prescribed what's covered and what's not covered. And they're still trying to get that language and that understanding that money will play a role at some point in time. What you don't want to do is find yourself where the money has set the conditions and they're the only conditions you feel you can work within. You're not able to back up away from that problem and tackle, you know, the intent of what your loved one really wants to achieve. You got to be careful not to get sucked to the light, to get so close into it. You know, once in the hospital settings, a great place that can happen. A lot of stuff going on, right?
So that's one of the policy changes I feel very strongly about in the book. Okay. And that is that, like, my sister never heard from her physicians about palliative care or hospice. But they did offer her a lung transplant. Now, and a lung transplant would have been millions of dollars and it wouldn't have worked. But they didn't pay for home care. They didn't support. And so what I'm saying is that, and if you had a conversation with a palliative care doctor, I'm suggesting that before you get transplants, one of my favorite statistics is that 6% of all healthcare spending is for kidney dialysis. And many of those people very seldom live for more than a year. And yet they automatically go on dialysis if they go into kidney failure without a palliative care consultation, without really understanding what that means.
Okay. And that's the way the system knows what, that's the way the system happens to function today, right?
It pays for things that we can measure.
Right.
And we can't measure conversations. We can't measure home care. And therefore the insurance model doesn't pay for stuff that would save money for everybody.
Right.
And would be much more beneficial to families, but it will pay for things that don't work.
Right. So then, you know, okay, so there, that's the medical system that you're walking into. If you're handing, if you're looking for that to solve your problem, that's likely where it's going to go, what it might move away from, or why the conditions are going to be set. So let's come into some of the other major dynamics here. Let's talk about our family and us and our outlooks of death and life, or what may or may not have been prepared kind of coming into that. In the book, one thing you and I both share a Catholic faith, one thing that you just really grabbed me by the throat by was looking at the use of the rosary, which are used off by Catholics in order to kind of to pray and to work through things, and the sorrowful mysteries in particular, where we may have just before, I just looked at a focus of Christ's death and what that came and what that may have meant for us, but being able to use that to absorb and to digest the death process, which 100% of us face at some point in time. I thought that was a great useful tool for me when it came in, but also just really highlighted, I'm a veteran. I've lost friends, I've lost colleagues, I've been myself at times where I didn't know if I was going to come out of the moment. I've lost my own little sister just a few months ago, so I can understand, and I've had to face a lot of death. But you still really challenged as to whether or not I fully am prepared to not allow my understanding of death to overly influence what my family members' experience of death is, or what they want, because ultimately I'm here to be an advocate for them in that case and time, right? What are some things you can think? I mean, what can help us process that, or maybe keep us from maybe getting too deep into our own problem instead of being able to advocate? Anything that comes to mind there?
Well, I mean, the core problem is that we don't want to talk about it, period. I mean, it that is the And actually, I have a little visual here. There's a cute card game that people have come up with. And it goes, to have my family with me. And it would be a child and a parent going through the card game. And they answer the question, this is very important to me. This isn't important to me. And then you sort to the most important items. And then you have this is a mechanism to have a conversation. It's because your mom and dad don't want to have the conversation, and you even want it less than they do. And so it is like, it's like giving your kid sex education. You just don't want to do it. And so, but it's important, and it helps. And actually, after people do it, they feel great. It's sort of like you don't want to exercise, but after you do it, you feel great. Well, you feel great after having the conversation. Now, part of it is learning about things, learning about, you know, what treatments you know, like, let's start with, do you want to die at home? And most people do. Like 80% of everybody wants to die at home. Well, I got news for you. It won't happen unless you've done a bunch of things to set that up in place. So, you know, it is, you know, the sorrowful mystery, it starts out with denial. The first thing is denial. And then there's agony. This is not easy stuff. And so it is working your way through it, but it's very rewarding when you actually do it.
Yeah.
And it frees you. It, you know, one of my favorite things right now is, like, I'm old enough not to worry too much about prevention. There's a great quote from somebody I have in the book that she says, I don't want to know about anything I don't feel. So, you know, I'm not going to look for whether I've got, you know, colon cancer or not. It's like, if I have it at this point, it is what it is. Now that's my choice. So a lot of people would have a different view of it, but I just raise that as a way of thinking. And then it's sort of the final release for the family and for you, is that in old age, you don't have to fight, you know, you don't have to throw everything to keep alive. Now, the problem with the children is they never want to lose their parent. And so when they're, you know, at that moment and say, you know, well, there's nothing more we can do. And doctors don't like to say that because there generally is something they can do. But when you get to that moment where there's nothing you can, you're still gonna, you're programmed to say, well, what about, isn't there anything? Isn't there? And that is not good.
Yeah. It seems to come from potentially that place of fear rather than that place of understanding or an acceptance of where those things are at. And that is, that's a lot for doctors to pick up. That's not one thing that we kind of actually glossed over too, for the doctors, or whether it be a family member or anything else, is the totality of just of death as you working through all of that can bring grief on our soul. And as we work through this and on our mind, maybe less our soul so much as our mind and our own processing of that and our own understanding of stuff. I can imagine the difficulty of medical professionals in having to consistently deal with death one time after another, if they haven't been able to address their own, you know, what its role plays in their own life or where those are at every time they've got someone that slides, especially when, and then you pile on the legal implications and pressures, the risk adverse nature, the responsibility they owe, not just to the patient, but to the profession in general. That is a complicated kind of ball of emotion that seems, even though it cloaks itself as if it's unemotional and not emotional with factual statements. And it's almost like you can get lost in the facts.
So one of the really important things here that causes problems is the word hope. So, you know, for example, people don't like to go to hospice because it symbolically means to them they've given up hope.
Oh, that's a misuse of hope. Got it. Yeah, yeah.
And the truth is, your life expectancy is longer in hospice than not going into hospice.
Yeah.
But that is counterintuitive, and doctors have trouble believing that's true, but it is.
Yeah.
So they're caught in this trap where if they tell you you're dying, they're taking away your hope. So they don't want to tell you that. And it's only if you free them, if you free them, they might not feel comfortable doing it. But you need to understand that we end up having unrealistic hope. Our family members have unrealistic hope. We have unrealistic hope. And hope's an important thing.
It is. I mean,
you don't want to give up on hope. And so you need to frame it in your head that you're not giving up hope. You're just accepting the reality of the situation.
Or maybe even where you're placing, where you're placing that hope.
Yeah.
Right. And that's probably a reason why faith maybe plays a big role for your life. I think it plays a big role for mine. But for others that are able to face death and work through death, that I've witnessed in my life and experiences, that placing that hope in their faith, that what it was they were supposed to accomplish was accomplished, right? Or that they
right.
did those things, and so they can look into the hope of transcendence and being able to transcend. I think that's probably a huge role, whether it's a Christian outlook or any faith outlook. Understanding transcendence, you know, having a that belief of that higher power, or that there's something there, I think probably plays a big role. Placing hope in that instead of hope, you know, that your fingers on the edge of the cliff don't fall out when it's inevitable. Eventually, it's going to happen. You can't hang there forever. That's not realistic, and that's maybe misplacing our hope in the world.
And so, another important psychology issue here is a concept of legacy.
Okay.
And so we all have a desire to have a legacy. That's how, when we're gone, we will be remembered. And there, if you haven't thought about the legacy you want, you are going to keep wanting to postpone dying. Because you have to, you know, if you can accept that you've sort of achieved your legacy. Now, that's not giving up hope. That's just accepting that the legacy of what you're going to do with your life has been pretty much achieved. And so it's okay to not keep going at it. But if you haven't thought about that and you don't want to think about it, then you have this desire to just keep going, no matter what.
Itch in the back of your neck. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I love how you piece that together. We're insanely complicated creatures. It does amaze me to the what detail we can understand, you know, the hand and the arm and to the veins and the legs and the other things there, but our understanding of the brain, you know, and how that moves us, or our understanding of the soul is still so far away from us. And it clearly plays a role off of this. Well, Maya, we're going to pause here for a moment to go into this next break. That is an amazing set of those dynamics, those doctors looking at failure, looking at risk, looking at the legal consequences and the responsibilities out there. You know, there's that medical understanding, the treatment, the system, the payer model, all those things that sit within it. There's how you're approaching as you walk into the situation. There's how your family or your other loved ones or other stakeholders may play a role as they step into that, and their ability to be prepared to step into that and to say goodbye at that role. That's a lot of dynamics in here. When we come back, let's make a resolution here and let's work on some stuff. Let's talk about putting a foot forward and how family members can start preparing themselves ahead of time. I remember you saying preparation takes effort. So what are the efforts that we can go after to prepare ourselves when we return with Michael Conley and The Journey's End here on the Parent Projects podcast? Stand by.
You're thinking about buying or selling. Maybe you're retiring, downsizing, or a major life event has made you consider a move. A Seniors Real Estate Specialist, or SRES, has unique training in helping 50-plus homebuyers and sellers. Why ask a Seniors Real Estate Specialist to assist you? An SRES understands the decision to move can be difficult and will provide you with an approach customized to suit your needs. They can help you navigate your choices because they have experience with 50-plus buyers and sellers and want to serve as a resource and guide. An SRES will patiently support you through each step. They will guide you through the major financial and lifestyle decisions involved in selling your family's home or moving to a new residence. They'll also tailor the marketing process to fit your needs and will be there when you need them. An SRES can draw upon a network of other professionals focused on 50-plus clients. Your SRES can provide referrals to a variety of resources at the local, state, and national level and on the internet. They're knowledgeable about senior housing options and can refer you to another SRES if you're planning to move outside the area. You can count on a seniors real estate specialist to guide you through the process of selling or buying your home, making the transaction less stressful and more successful.
Welcome back. And this week we've got Michael Connelly, author of The Journey's End, which truly is an investigation into death and dying here in modern America, with a lot of great opportunities for us to make some improvements in how we look at death, how we handle death. Most importantly for our audience, how do we advocate for somebody who is taking those final steps? Michael, thanks again for joining us in the studio today virtually. And this is it's a blessing to have you. Thanks for being here.
It's a blessing to be here.
So, brother, we've gone through these dynamics, and it's a mess. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you're walking into, but it's real. It's a real part of life. And there is there's some real things that we can do and efforts that we can put into play that help us tackle that mess with a little more grace, a little more understanding, and probably a little more control. And I was hoping that we could really focus at some of those here for this last 15 minutes or so. I think maybe one of the first things to start is you began this when I asked of how we prepare for death. You'd stated, and what does it mean to be alive? You've talked about maybe some of this card game or some other things. What are some ideas of that? How do we tackle, what does it mean to be alive? What's the core tenets of that to you?
So, I mean, for me, it's I'm helping others. I mean, I was put on earth to, you know, serve others. And, you know, I don't want to become a burden. Now, you can help others as a burden. So I'm not just saying the definition of, but you also don't want to rob your children and their children of their lives by having to devote all of their time to you. And so that, you know, and so for me, I'm not, you know, really anxious to stay around forever. I mean, for me, it's okay. I had a wonderful life and it's okay. And they may, you know, they think I'm a little wacko when I say that stuff to them, but it is important to kind of figure that out in your own mind and get comfortable with what it is you want.
At the end of the last segment, as we came through, we talked a bit about legacy, and I think that practically can serve a really good way to think through if you're having a hard time getting out of your own way and understanding it. And it happens because it's a really loud, messy world around us. That might be a way to get yourself out of your head. Think about that legacy and how you would want to be remembered. And I have an inkling in my heart, in my head here, just to say that that's probably a great way to start thinking about what your calling is. If you haven't grabbed your calling or your destiny or whatever you might be in life and how it is that you sort yourself and orient yourself in living. Thinking about how you're going to be remembered might be a great way to back your way into, have I accomplished what I was looking to do, or what is the purpose that I've got to do there so that I know the day in which I can rest?
So another little psychological tool to deal with that is you can talk about your professional resume, and then you can talk about your eulogy resume. And are they different? What do you want to be remembered for as distinct from what did you accomplish? And that's just an interesting nuance.
Yeah.
To think about. But
well, that's a practical, we've heard that before on the show as a practical recommendation when your loved one's having a hard time, whom you're advocating for,
right,
to get them to start ideating where they need to move. Yeah.
And so, I mean, the problem is a lot of people can never get out of their resume, you know, they just can't stop. And there is, when you age, one guy put it, you need a reverse bucket list. You need to think about the things you no longer are going to do. And that's, I think that's another helpful idea, because there's less and less you physically can do. And so accepting that, you know, beginning to say, all right, you know, and again, this is that little dilemma with hope. You don't want to stop trying. On the other hand, you don't want to try things that are unrealistic anymore. You know, like, I'm not going to get up on a ladder anymore. I mean, I'd like to say I'm man enough to get up there and fix that. It's a bad idea to get on a ladder. It just is a very bad idea. And so, but I mean, in terms of practical things we can do, I want to make sure we talk about advanced directives and advanced care planning. Those sound like technical terms, but the advanced directive is where a person has the opportunity to state in writing what they want at end of life. And unfortunately, this whole process hasn't worked in our country. And it hasn't worked because it's developed as a checklist and it's developed as a legal document. Neither one of those are terribly helpful. What it should be is an educational activity. And it should be parked in a doctor's office, and it should be a routine conversation after, you know, whenever you're starting to become frail. And the there are a list of things that you really want to be specific about. Like on my advanced directives, they're called a natural death. So I want a natural death. I don't want a mechanical death. I don't want to die in ICU. And so now it's fairly easy for me to declare that, you know, I don't want a feeding tube. I do not want a ventilator. I do not want a transplant. I mean, but unless you're specific, because the catch-all checklist on most of these forms is something called extraordinary care. Well, I got news for you. There's no definition of extraordinary care. And the third parties that are making these decisions will define it as, you know, anything that might keep you alive. So it doesn't protect you from getting overtreated at the end. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the conversation, though, as you started off that, the conversation of this should be educational.
Yes.
It should be a talk through all of that, right? We've had this room. I have this bug in my ear from our conversation with Otto Schill some time ago, and an attorney who, you know, worked a lot of this stuff, and he cared for his family members for his dad or his mom as she was passing. He's an attorney doing that as well, right? Very well aware, especially, and that's his kind of area of law, tax, and then also estates and stuff. But he had to understand that death was inevitable, and that eventually there would be some decision he would make that would not. Could he have done something different in hindsight? Maybe that's the decision he had in front of him, and he was going to make those decisions. But he had conversations enough to know things like, you know, doesn't necessarily want to be resuscitated at one. You know, doesn't want to be resuscitated again and again and again to work off of that, but. When it was just a matter of slip down in the shower and needed a resuscitation, you know, out of context, right? This wasn't in a hospital. It's working off of all of this. Was able to think had the wherewithal to think through, okay, well, what's the application? What were we talking about? How did it come through? It's that actual educational perspective that gave him peace of mind to know how to act and how to put that thing into play. Because like you said, I mean, they're pretty big terms, and they're broad terms. Excuse me. You've got to be maybe specific there, or you make some other suggestions of even also having that conversation and recording it.
Yes.
Right. that seems like it would add some great context. I don't know about you, but I really struggle with email in highly emotional situations. It frustrates me to see emails go back and forth, and writing, and even letters, even to that nature. I prefer to see the facial expression and the way that somebody intends to do something. Is that kind of where that can that play a role when you're doing
it? It is. And so there are two documents that end up being developed. One is the advanced care directive, which is where you try to specify what you want or don't want. The other document is the healthcare power of attorney. And that's the person that you designate to make your choices. Now, that person is supposed to be guided by your direction. You know, if you've never had a conversation with them about what you want, which is what happens, and you know, you think of, you know,
yeah,
and so neither one of those becomes too helpful. And then furthermore, if another family member disagrees with the one that has the health care of attorney, the doctor's like, well, I'm not sure that'll protect me. So no, we're just gonna. And so the video is a little more powerful. It is, and it sort of helps deal with the aberrant family member that is not going along. And so that's just another. There are also videos out there about different end of life treatments, and that's a very powerful way to educate people. So, you know, I mean, if you're dying, I mean, the leading causes are, you know, heart failure, cancer, respiratory or COPD. I mean, you can learn about these things and the stages that you're going to go through.
Yeah.
And your doctors aren't going to talk to you about this stuff. One of the other problems we haven't talked about is fragmented care. And what that comes from is that one of the great gifts of medicine is all of our specialization. All that specialization, however, has caused the specialists to just look at you with whatever they're working on.
Yeah.
And so they're coming at this, all right, I can conquer cancer. Well, all the side effects of cancer, that isn't what they think about. Or if it's heart failure, it's how do I just keep your heart pumping? Well, you may have a lot of other things going south. And these people don't talk to one another because, frankly, they're not paid to talk to one another. And you don't have any general person to talk to, which is what palliative care could be, about how do I weigh all these different options and how do I balance these different points of view. And so things just slip by and you end up in a nobody knows what's going on situation, and it's very frustrating for a family. Well, you know, the first step is knowing that you kind of expect this. This is how we designed the system. And so, you know, if you're going to be the navigator, you may have to kind of force the doctors to talk to one another or get, you know, different, you know, like my sister's primary care doctor had one approach to treating COPD, but the pulmonologist had a different approach. And she's like, but they don't talk to each other. So there was no reconciliation. Who does she agree with? Right? You know, and that is the kind of dilemma that people end up with.
Well, and those are, you know, we had a similar thing just in caring for one of my kiddos. I had a lot of conflicting, different people wanted to treat different things in multiple, you know, fragmented care. And so I made an appointment and I had them all on the call. And I brought them all into the room to work through that conversation. We pulled out, maybe he shouldn't be on this one medication that one had given because this one over here kind of created a conflict. Wasn't a huge red flag enough to have been hit before, but in the context of how it was being used, led to someone thinking, well, maybe we could use this other thing and have no risk of complication against this if we just shift this different direction. And that perspective really does a lot. You know, one person I'll put out to families, if your family's struggling with that, if you're really fragmented, the use of a healthcare advocate, of somebody who understands the healthcare system in general, who understands the payers model system, by the way, right. They know the ICD-10 codes, they know how that comes together and what's likely to follow or what to see. They do, they can do a great job of helping your family hold that stuff together, of painting that broad brush, of understanding and coaching you ahead of time and what conversation to have with one particular specialist when you get that 6.5 minutes with them. Or even to help you find some of those doctor's offices, which we're seeing pop up now all over the place, that are committing themselves to geriatric family medicine in a more holistic level, where they're, and I don't mean holistic just of naturopathic, but just looking at the whole big picture, giving more than 6.5 minutes of being a whole office dedicated to use video teleconferencing, and you know, that they can get 15, 20 minutes with the patient in order to really settle in and to understand the full perspective. So I think that would be a great place to even challenge. Make sure if you've got that power of attorney or that advanced directive too, great opportunity to ask, you know, if you're headed down one of these paths, is there something we're not thinking about? Should we have a discussion? Would we, in your experience, would we face some particular medical, are we headed down some medical conversation that we might have to have, or a decision we have to make that we can talk about now? Those would be great aspects of that. I love you getting us thinking about those conversations up front, documenting those conversations up front.
Right.
Of how that comes through. Yeah. How about understanding palliative care? What's your recommendation? How does a family or an advocate, what's a good way to start getting your feet wet and understanding what palliative care is? Because it's probably not, it highly likely something that's not going to be presented to you up front.
So palliative care is intended to be a team of individuals led by a physician. And that team of individuals would be social worker, pastoral care, a nurse, and them taking a holistic view of your situation. And then each of them has an expertise on how to access whichever thing needs to be most important. And anybody that's got a major chronic illness, a consultation with a palliative care team would be highly desirable. Now, getting one or finding one, and so step one might be to research whether they exist in your community.
Yeah.
And then that might help create some pressure to make them available. Let me jump to hospice a little bit, because hospice is really built off a palliative care model. But hospice has three problems with it, which make it having a massive marketing problem. So the first problem is that your doctor needs to declare you're going to die in 6 months. So you can't get into hospice without that declaration. I have news for you, but no doctor wants to declare you're going to die in 6 months. So the doctor is not going to mention the idea of hospice, because it sort of implies he's willing to say that. Now, you can call a hospice directly and they will provide a doctor which will do that. So there's a way over that. The second problem is that when you go on hospice, you give up your regular Medicare insurance. And that's like, wait a minute, you know, I'm officially giving up hope, and I still might want to try something. Well, it turns out if they let you do both, it would work out wonderfully for everybody, but they don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the second problem. Now, you are free to jump back, meaning you can go back to Medicare and get out of hospice anytime you want.
But it's complicated. It's a complicated process to come off hospice, go back into the system, even to get an ambulance ride, to work through all of that, the declarations, what has to be waived, to come back into it.
But I think that, and then the third problem is that hospice doesn't have a very strong home care benefit.
Yeah.
And the home care benefit for hospice should grow significantly. But there was a study that just came out that I think is powerful. It said that people in hospice save Medicare $3.2 billion annually.
Hmm.
Yet Medicare is not And if they just let loose of all those requirements, if they just said no 6 months, if you have a terminal illness, you're eligible, period. You know, if there's no reason why you couldn't get, what happens with people that have curative care is that they love the palliative care so much more that they stop getting the curative care. They abandon it, but they choose when and how to abandon it.
Right.
And so if you, and these aren't major complicated changes that our Congress couldn't just do, but that's one of my big points in the book.
Yeah. Well, those are, look, that's part of the mind shift. And that is this thinking outside the box is our focus over the course of the month of May, as we really start thinking about what needs to happen. How do we, look, there's a lot that comes at us that we don't have a lot of control over. We just have to kind of absorb it and then work our way through it as best as possible. But this is one. Look, in this target market, in this age group, this baby boomer group who is stepping up and still taking care of their parents, you know, in their mid-70s and into their 80s, you have incredible buy power and you have incredible opportunity at this point in time to reach out and to make and affect some levels of change so that things are in a better position for you as you get there and also for your loved one. You know, reaching out, being, you know, reach out to your lawmakers and talk with them about the importance of palliative care and that you want to see palliative care and you want to see improvements in how dignity is carried through life the entire span, right? All the way through to a natural, to that natural death, and that's an important thing for you. This is a time to probably make yourself a little thing you can do on the side to send that off just to start that voice and to get those things going. Because there's such a large amount of you dealing with this right now.
One of the things you could do to get access to palliative care quickly is seek a hospice consult.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that's what I did with my sister. My sister wasn't ready to go into hospice psychologically, but I called it palliative care. And then when the people from hospice showed up, she was so felt so comfortable with that nurse.
Yeah.
That, and then she qualified.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, a whole burden of fear was released. And then you emphasize that you're likely to live longer in hospice than you are in active treatment.
Exactly.
It's sort of like a no lose proposition. Right. Just jump to hospice. But nobody's going to offer that to you. And but you can literally call the number directly and they'll send somebody out.
Yeah, that is it's a great practical advice too for you. If you sense that that's where you are, your family's moving close to that end of life, highly valuable for you. But Michael, this is just, it's a wealth of information. We talked about those dynamics again, from the doctors to the way the medicine's set up, to the way it's tested, the incentives, the impact of the payer systems against things, those challenges of ourselves in our own way and what we deal with as advocates just in our own life. And then, you know, we started broken down on the backside of it. You gave some great valuable opportunities in how you start leaning forward, understanding what does it mean to be alive, facing death in yourself, right? Use of things like these card games, which, by the way, I'll get from you and I'd like to put down in our show notes down below off, you know, after the show.
Right.
We'll put that down there so that if you're interested in getting to those things. Also, look, check out parentprojects.com. We've got examples of these key documents that sit out there. Find, you know, we don't give legal advice, you should always try to find that person who's licensed in your particular area. We know our viewers come from all over the country. So check in. You're going to find a family or an estate law attorney. You're going to find somebody who can work with those. A lot of doctor's offices as well can give you, and the medical community that you work with can give you some help on those advanced directives. If faith plays a role in your loved one's life today, I highly suggest that you reach out to their parish or to their church and you ask if they have documents and guidance that's in line with what those beliefs are for them, is particularly around the advanced directive. A lot of them have those documents and they have the templates and that can guide your conversations. And that's probably one of the biggest takeaways I took from you, Michael, was having the conversation early and often, breaking it down, getting to as much detail as possible. And if it doesn't fit into a piece of paper, just turn on a cell phone, get a good recording and to understand to what their wishes are and revisit it. Because Lord knows, you know, I have not achieved my purpose yet. And so my advanced directive is going to be one level. But once I've achieved that and that's come across, I know that's going to change. And I might not remember to go back and update that advanced directive. So I would hope that my kids are watching this and they will come back and remind me to come back at it. But anything in there that I missed, sir?
No, you've done a wonderful job summarizing the key issues.
Well, I think you did a wonderful job guiding that conversation. I do. I just want to highlight you again. And The Journey's End is the book that you guys have out there today in the investigation of death and dying in modern America. And Roman and Littlefield is the publisher for it. Where can we find this book?
Amazon. It's, you know, everybody gets books on Amazon.
Wonderful. So you can find them down on Amazon. If they I think we just also had a website up there. Any other place if people want to get a hold of you or a way that they can ask more
I would gladly help anybody that wants to discuss this. If my email is up there. And if you want to email me and you want me to come talk to a group or you want to just talk to me one-on-one, I'd be glad to help.
Michael, you've been a blessing for us. It's been awesome. Thank you for sharing your time, talents, and treasures with us and our listeners today.
It's been a privilege.
Well, that's it for the team this week, and thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed the content, remember to subscribe and to share this episode on the app that you're using right now. Your reviews and your comments, they really help us expand our reach as well as our perspective. So if you have time, also drop us a note. Let us know how we're doing. For tips and tools to clarify your parent project, simplify communication with your stakeholders, and verify the professionals that you choose, you can find us on YouTube, follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks again for trusting us. Until our next episode, behold and be held.
Thank you for listening to this Parent Projects podcast production. To access our show notes, resources, or forums, join us on your favorite social media platform or go to parentprojects.com. This show is for informational and educational purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional credentialed in your local area. This show is copyrighted by Family Media and Technology Group Incorporated and Parent Projects LLC. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcast.